Hi, Ed Straw here to introduce you to a bonus podcast that's going to be appearing in this feed called Aramco F1 Focus. Don't worry, Gary and I will still be bringing you the Race F1 Tech Show every 2 weeks throughout the season, but as an added extra, you'll also get this show, which will focus on interesting and lesser known aspects of Grand Prix racing. So without further ado, here's Aramco F1 Focus.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Aramco F1 Focus, a brand new podcast on this feed which aims to bring you fresh perspectives, performance insights and statistical surprises to enhance your enjoyment of Grand Prix racing. My name's Tim Sylvie and I'm joined by two men who know a thing or two about a thing or two when it comes to Formula One. First up, you may know him on Twitter as Virtual Statman, where his bio proudly states that he's been making statistics the new rock and roll since 2003. It's the Statman to the stars, Sean Kelly. Sean, how are you? Are you excited to be bringing the listeners some searing statistical insights over the course of this series?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm very passionate about the facts and figures behind the sport, and hopefully I can transmit that to our listeners.
Fantastic. But it's not just Sean and I on this podcast. Oh no. Joining us each episode to give us the lowdown on driver performance, it's none other than sports car ace, broadcaster, and all-round nice guy, Alex Brundle. Alex, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, Tim, and I'm going to be bringing performance points in relation to the previous races and races that are coming up from the various drivers, and have a bit of a deep dive into some specific elements of how the drivers have been performing.
And as well as hearing from Alex and Sean, we'll also be bringing you the thoughts of some very special guests in our Aramco Focus. So, now you know the format, let's get into it. It's time for our first area of focus, our stat focus. Now, Sean, the opening two races of the season have already thrown up a load of interesting statistics. But what did you want to talk about today?
Well, I think there's this idea that Red Bull are suddenly running away with it, and it's you know, it's a one horse race, and we've never seen dominance like it in Formula One. But I would caution against that, because it's really not that. It's really one of those short memory type situations that we get quite a lot in Formula One, when somebody gets off to a good start and you think, oh, well, it's all over and done with. Well, actually, that's not the case. For a start, the front to back split, the difference between the fastest car on the grid and the slowest car on the grid, is actually closer than it's ever been in the history of Formula One. In Bahrain, in Q1, the gap front to back, first to last, was 1.188 seconds. That's the closest Q1 we've ever had in Formula One. Now, bear in mind, the Formula One has the 107% rule to weed out the slower cars, you know, the people who we think are not good enough to be in Formula One. Well, the percentage gap from front to back was 1.3%. So if we'd had a 102% rule, every car would have still qualified. So that's how close the field is right now. It's given a slightly unbalanced perspective, because it seems that Red Bull are so strong, particularly in race pace.
Do you think that Red Bull dominance will continue? I mean, does history give us any indication to go by? How long are they going to be dominating like this? Can you put a timestamp on it?
Well, normally, I mean, I would be lying to you if I said that Red Bull are not obviously a strong favourite based on what we've seen so far. But what we do have is some unknowns, and that is, we're now working around financial regulations, which were never the case for most of World Championship history. And they also have this penalty overhanging from last season, where they can't use the wind tunnel as much. And we don't know yet exactly how that will affect them from now onwards. We know that they've come out the gates really well, but will it affect them in the long haul? Will we get to, you know, the latter half of the European season and that advantage has been eroded? We don't know that yet. So it's not fair to, you know, give them the trophy just yet. There's plenty to come, and we've still got 21 races still to go. It's very early.
Yeah. You alluded to the cost cap there. How much does that come into the equation? Because presumably that does level, or the intention is to level the playing field. How much of a contribution has that had?
Well, we've already seen what I call a bounce from the lower teams in the Constructors' Championship in the last two seasons. I mean, we saw last year Haas and Alfa Romeo, who were two of the bottom teams, to the two bottom teams in the previous year's championship, suddenly were in Q3 and qualifying the top eight and being very, very competitive. in the following season because, well, not necessarily because, but perhaps because they had more time and more resources than the front-running teams, as per the regulations. And this year, obviously, we've seen with Aston Martin, they've made a huge jump, which I think is the envy of everybody else in Formula One right now. How have Aston Martin managed to do that, and how do we do that?
And we'll come on to Aston Martin, I'm sure, a little bit later. And we can talk about dominance in terms of the cars themselves, but when we look at front to back and that convergence of the teams, how much of that can you put down to not just, you know, cost cap or mechanical scenarios, but how much of that can be attributed to the quality of the drivers themselves? Are they relatively close together?
Well, that's probably more a question for Alex than myself. I'm sure he's got plenty of insight on that basis. But what I would say from my perspective is, I mean, I don't look at that grid and see any pay drivers. I mean, obviously, maybe some of them are paying, bringing sponsorship, but there's no one there who I think to myself, you really shouldn't be here. I mean, there's been plenty of seasons in the past where you think, why is this driver in Formula One? He wouldn't be here but for, you know, family money or something like that. But we've got 20 guys on the grid right now who all have their own, you know, record to put for their junior record that says, yeah, they should be in F1. So it's fantastic. We've got a grid that's about quality rather than quantity. We've only got 20 cars, but 20 very good drivers.
I think the level of technical excellence at the front of Formula One, well, throughout the field in Formula One, is such that they're putting the drivers in the best position to perform. And actually what you're seeing is a closing of the field in relation to the fact that that's just the gap between a good driver and a driver who's towards the back of the field. In F1 machinery now, I mean, we're dealing with tyres widths away from apexes being the difference between a good qualifying lap and a bad qualifying lap. And an undisclosed sports car driver who jumped back into a Formula One car very recently, who shared the Le Mans grid with me, said, if you're more than half a second off in a modern Formula One car, there's either a problem with the car or you shouldn't be there. And that rang in my ears as an indication of just how well these teams are preparing their cars and their drivers now.
Yeah. And do you think over time, as people and teams get used to new regulations, are we going to see this grid get even closer? Can it get closer front to back?
Typically, we would see that. Usually, when you have a generation of regulations, if I can call it that, and I think that this current generation began last year when we made the big aero changes, went back to using a ground effect first time since 1982. Normally, that's when you see a big spread of performance front to back. That's usually where it sort of explodes from first to last. But actually, we didn't see that last year. Zandvoort last year was the closest percentage split we'd ever had, and then it was beaten again in Bahrain. So it's astonishing that we've had this huge, huge change in regulations, and yet the teams are still so close together. If you think back to when the hybrid era began in 2014, Mercedes were miles ahead. And you know, we've heard Lewis Hamilton and other people say, wow, this Red Bull is the fastest car we've ever seen. It's in a different league. Well, if you cast your minds back to 2014 and 2015, Mercedes were even further ahead. They were qualifying a second quicker than anybody else. I can remember the restart in Bahrain in 2014, late in the race, when Rosberg and Hamilton were fighting. In two laps, they were 8 seconds ahead of everybody else. In two laps! You know, that's unbelievable. But we haven't had that this time. Red Bull are comfortable, but they're not absolutely steamrolling people in the way that Mercedes did, or, you know, the Senna and Prost McLaren era, or even the Schumacher-Ferrari era.
I do think it reflects the way that we look at closeness in sport, and it's something that as a driver frustrated me tremendously when you'd have your best finish in seven races and then you would arrive in eighth instead of 10th or something like that and be completely ignored. Then, reflective of hypocrisy of a driver turned broadcaster, we focus in on the front of the field so much, don't we? And we appear to view the championship over the battle for the lead. And the battle for the lead at the moment doesn't look that close. But when you look from sort of Alonso backwards, it is incredibly close indeed. Do you think we'll view, though, when you look back at it, when you look back, for example, at the Schumacher era of dominance, do you think, Sean, that we'll view this era as a close era, despite the fact it is a close era, just because the battle for the front of the race is not close, but even though the field is very tight?
Well, from my perspective, I take your point about the midfield battle can be somewhat overlooked because, you know, the battle at the front, maybe there isn't a battle. You know, Max Verstappen won 15 races last year, and it kind of seems like it was one-way traffic. It didn't feel like that to me last year, compared to, for instance, I think the ultimate night shift we ever had in Formula One was when Schumacher was winning every race in 2004. He won 13 races that year, and he won, I think he won 12 of the first 13. If I remember correctly, or something close to that, don't quote me on it, but I think that's about right. So in 2004, it was complete one-way traffic, and there was never any sense that Rubens Barrichello was going to approach Michael, even if he did, that he was going to be talked off the ledge by the Ferrari pit wall. At least in this instance, we have the two Red Bull drivers, certainly in Saudi, being surprisingly competitive. I don't think anybody had Checo Perez being able to hold that gap to Max Verstappen. Once Verstappen got into second place, he was only 5 seconds behind Checo. And in the remainder of the race, he only closed one more second. We all thought that Perez was going to be dead meat out there, and that was not the case. And that actually bodes quite well. So that battle up front, to me, is still quite close. Perhaps it's only an intra-team battle. But we saw that in 1988 with McLaren, when they were street clear. I remember at Imola in 1988, the third place car on the grid was 3.3 seconds off pole. The third place car. Bearing in mind in Q1 in the first two races, it's been like 1.3 to last place. So that's a real gap. That's a big gap. But yet we had a tremendous championship battle that year, and no one thinks of it as being a boring season. So it's still everything to play for.
Well, you go back even further to like the 80s, and 50% of the cars that start the race will finish with, you know, drive start issues and all of that kind of thing. I actually disagree with you, though, that battle at the front of the field is tight. I mean, you see Max Verstappen start in 15th by half distance, 25 laps into a 50 lap Grand Prix. He was sitting second behind Sergio Perez. And then they sort of both charge off into the distance unchallenged. You've got a Red Bull team there who, yes, there's more to come. Helmut Marko's already said, yeah, we'll start to reduce our advantage as this season goes on with the 63% of the wind tunnel time available to the Red Bull team that everybody else has got. Do you think that that battle at the front of the field not being close enough represents a failure for this cost cap aero tweak rule set, Sean? Because, you know, you have got a dominant team.
Well, I take your point. I am being optimistic. I tend to look at it and think, well, look, you know, it's not over and done with yet. I mean, remember, 12 months ago, we were all thinking, well, Leclerc and Ferrari, it's in the bag. You know, the Red Bull are all over the place. And look where we ended up that season. So, you know, that's why I'm cautious. Is there a failure of the regulations? I wouldn't say it was a failure, because bear in mind, it's always a work in progress. You know, Formula One regulations are always being tweaked as innovation moves along. So if in certain elements, they might say, look, this bit hasn't worked, this bit's made things worse, and so on. So you're always trying to make running changes to the package, because of course, You know, Formula One designers. I mean, you give them a rules package, and they'll find a way around it. So there'll be something that they have to legislate against that no one's thought of yet. So I'm not so pessimistic as to say the whole thing's been a failure. And I do think there's been some success. What the big success is not actually a performance thing, and the big success is that we don't look at teams like Williams or Haas and think, are they going to be going bust by the next race? Hmm. And those were genuine concerns pre cost cap, where you think, you know, what are the back of the grid teams going to do? Now we don't have that concern, and we think we've got 10 healthy teams. And actually, now we're at the point where people, you know, the teams don't want to sell up because they're thinking, hang on a minute, this is appreciating. We don't want to hang on to this, and we don't want an 11th team because this is going so well. So that means it's, on that perspective, the regulations have been really a fantastic success.
Very good. Thank you, Sean. Let's wrap up the stat focus there. Listeners, if you have any comments or questions or to agree or even disagree with anything you've heard, make sure to get in touch with us through our socials. It's always good to hear from you. So now we're going to move on to our next focus. It's time for our resident racing driver to take us inside the cockpit and give us the lowdown on a fascinating aspect of driver performance. So, Alex, what are you going to focus on?
Well, firstly, I should say I was playing a little bit of devil's advocate. I do agree it's a fabulous rule set and it's brought everyone closer together, which means we're seeing the driver's skills, especially around a circuit like Jeddah in Saudi Arabia exposed. But, you know, we've had two different layouts this year, a 15-turn Bahrain International Circuit, extremely abrasive. C1 and upwards tyres were used. Then the 27-turn Jeddah Corniche circuit in Saudi Arabia, where 50% of the corners of that circuit are faster than the fastest corner in Bahrain, far less abrasive. You're using the C4 tyre as the softest. And my point is that you see several key drivers. Fernando Alonso is one of them. I thought Lewis Hamilton delivered an exceptional performance in Jeddah as well. They tend to be sort of towards the later end of their career. And you see those drivers able to adapt, able to change between delivering in one type of venue, a very abrasive, slower speed, then delivering at another type of venue, very high speed, very brave, daring between the walls. And I actually feel like the key to success in Formula One in 2023 is that adaptability. And it's been great to see the drivers gather which of the drivers are able to do that and which of the drivers are not able to do that.
It's a lovely, lovely topic. Now, there are many factors that contribute to a successful race car driver in Formula One. There's so many circuits. They have so many different factors contributing towards their makeup. Is it possible to be a successful Formula One driver without necessarily that really strong ability to adapt? Can you make up for it in other ways?
I really think no, because, you know, the few sports car drivers that I've shared a race car with outside of Formula One have always impressed me with their understanding of the race car, their ability to manipulate the race car. Those who cannot do that, I don't think last very long in Formula One, because, you know, you take the junior single seaters series. There are several drivers who float around sort of the back end of the top 10, maybe don't quite make it. And the excuse often bandied is, oh, well, they took a year to get their head around the tyre, for example, how the front tyre builds temperature, how the car then feels when the front tyre's built temperature. You know, Formula One drivers get maybe two test days at the beginning of the year, if they're allowed all of that testing time, you know, with the various rookies and juniors jumping in the car. Then they jump between from a brand new C1 tyre that they don't have any feel of around Bahrain onto the next compound. And they'll maybe get 5 or 10 laps to figure out how that tyre is going to build temperature, the key tweaks to driving style that need to be made to make that tyre work. The ultimate example of that for me was I watched FP2 in Jeddah from Fernando Alonso's perspective. The rear soft tyre was moving around all over the place, and I watched him jockey the soft tyre through the first sector in Saudi, then jump over to the medium tyre, much more stability, much more understeer, and all of a sudden his technique turned to silk as he drove the medium tyre. And I just think that those drivers are the drivers that make it. The drivers that can't do that between the different venues are just not in a position to succeed in modern day F1.
Now, you mentioned some of the factors there, like, you know, the type of road that the drivers are on, the abrasiveness. But there are other factors as well. When you're traveling between, I don't know, you know, Bahrain, and then, you know, the next week, you might be in a very different climate with different weather, different heats, humidities. I mean, you can really dive deep into this subject, can't you? Because there are so many factors, these slightly more subtle ones as well. And how much do they affect the adaptability of a driver?
Well, it's adaptability between regarding everything. And that's why, you know, you look at Angela Cullen leaving Lewis Hamilton's side after many, many years of being supportive of him. You know, that's adaptability too, because everything from when you arrive on a, you know, a Wednesday or a Thursday morning, all the way through practice, all the way through qualifying, and how you drive the race is important to how a driver feels. It needs to flow absolutely naturally. So, yeah, you know, adaptability to the climate. You'll see drivers turn up incredibly early, for example, for a race like Australia, to make sure that their head's in the right place, to make sure that they've handled the time change, to make sure they've handled the climatic conditions. And those adaptabilities are very important. But I really do think it's more a case of, you know, you look at the change, for example, that George Russell has made, moving from what was an incredibly low downforce Williams, which they've you know, taken that philosophy through into the next car, into the Mercedes, which is a bit more draggy, a bit more high downforce. That's a totally out of the window driving style change for George Russell to make. And the fact that he can move to the pace immediately in a draggier, higher downforce Mercedes, which will need a totally different feel for the brake pedal, a totally different concept of in and out of the corner, is an incredibly impressive thing, alongside a new team structure, a new engineering structure, a new physiotherapy structure. And so I think that's why he's able to jump in and perform alongside Lewis Hamilton.
Now, before we move on from this section, drivers come from different backgrounds, right? But typically in Formula One, you're going to come from a single seater background. But is that to say that if you've had a lot of experience in GTs or LMP cars or even sim racing, you know, something that we're seeing more and more of, the likes of Jen Bulut-Bassey, who's done F2 and then going into Super Formula, has a very heavy sim racing background. Is it still possible to adapt to Formula One if you've come from not so much of a single-seater background?
Well, this really interests me because, you know, you look at someone like Kevin Magnussen or indeed Fernando Alonso. Us sports car drivers love Fernando Alonso because we like to talk about the Triple Crown. It's the great joy of drivers who've not made it to Formula One. So we love to talk about who's going to be able to connect those three races together. And I really think your exact sequence of experiences affects you. You know, Fernando Alonso clearly has a huge range of experiences to draw on, and that's what's helping him get the most out of that Aston Martin. But then you look at somebody like Nyck de Vries, who's had a really difficult time in his early stages at AlphaTauri, and you think, you know, surely Formula E, energy recovery, management of an energy system, plus sports car racing, management of a tyre, management of a car over the long stint would put him in a fantastic position to deliver in a Formula One car alongside his clear speed that he delivered in Formula 2. But it's not gelling together. So it's hard to put together an exact formula for what's going to make a driver successful when they jump out of a myriad of different formulae into a Formula One car, and whether that's actually going to prepare them better than the junior single-seater series do. But what's abundantly clear, and what Yuki Tsunoda, interestingly, was saying about Nyck de Vries, is that it's an incredibly different approach from those drivers who've had a rounded experience, you know, from someone like, for example, Felipe Drugovich or Lando Norris, who've just moved through the single-seater series one at a time. And I do think these teams benefit massively from having a little bit of both, perhaps in the way that Aston Martin do with Lance Stroll across of F3 sort of descendants across the garage from Fernando Alonso, who has that huge and varied experience.
Great stuff there, Alex. Thank you. A cracking focus. Now, having gone purple in the first two sectors, we're flying into the final sector now, which is our Aramco focus. And who better to lean into our first episode than Aston Martin, who have been a surprise package of the season so far, to the delight of many. Sean, what's impressed you most about Aston Martin so far this year?
Well, really, what hasn't impressed us about Aston Martin this year? They've had they had a reasonably good 2021. They actually were on the podium twice in 2021, but Sebastian Vettel was disqualified in Hungary. So officially, it was only the one podium. Last year they fell back a bit. I have to say it was not the season that they would have expected, but they made the best use of the financial regulations that we discussed about, where you get more wind tunnel time. There's a possibility to catapult yourself forwards. We heard in pre-season a lot of whispers, oh, Aston Martin have got something in the wind tunnel. They've got something great. And, you know, now you hear that usually every pre-season and you're always thinking, okay, so it's the usual talk. They've got a new car. It's going to be 12 seconds a lap faster and they're going to lap everybody 10 times. And then when the cards go on the table, you know, they've hardly made any progress. To our surprise in Bahrain, we were sitting there thinking, Alonso could be on pole here. We had not seriously considered this as a possibility. So the very fact that that's a conversation at all, that's impressive enough. But they're also able to hold their own on race pace. Obviously, they have one of the great drivers in history in one of their cars. But they had one of the great drivers in history in one of their cars last year as well. And there was only so much he could do with it. So they've done a fantastic job. I must say that Lawrence Stroll, the impresario who oversees the whole thing, there's some sort of cynicism brought towards Lawrence Stroll because they think, oh, well, he just wants to be an F1 team owner, but he actually wants to win. That's the key part. It's a bit like how Dietrich Mateschitz was with Red Bull. He didn't just want to buy a team and say, hey, I'm an F1 team owner. No, we're here also to win championships. And clearly Lawrence Stroll is here to win championships. The way he's invested in the factory and the way he's expanded the base and, you know, brought in Vettel, brought in Alonso. You know, these are huge names to bring into a team, especially given where their record was. So the way they've brought everything together has been very, very impressive. And dare I say it, reminds me of how Red Bull were in their early seasons, because they had a few seasons in the doldrums before they really hit it big. And that's where Aston Martin are, right on the curve. They're on the cusp of jumping into being a regular contender.
It has sort of come out of nowhere in many ways. And as you say, the team do have very bold ambitions and they've got this lovely, shiny new headquarters at Silverstone coming online, which is obviously going to really transform them in a number of ways. Is there any danger of them growing too much too soon?
There's always that danger. There's always the danger that the team can become bloated. There are many cautionary tales of yesteryear of teams trying to expand too quickly and just ending up being a muddled, unfocused mess, basically. I won't name any names, but I'm sure our listeners could probably come up with a few. But yes, there is that possibility. They obviously need to keep the focus as the team grows and the, you know, competitiveness increases and so on. The big challenge I think Aston Martin have this year by far is, can they maintain this pace? Because if you cast your mind back to last year, Haas were, you know, they finished fifth in the opening race of the season. Alfa Romeo, Valtteri Bottas scored like 46 points in the first half of the season and then only scored something like 2 points in the second half of the season because everybody sort of came back to earth. You know, they went back to their standard position. So the challenge for Aston Martin, yes, they've done the first part. They've got a car that came out the gate very, very fast. And perhaps they've been a little bit flattered because Ferrari are a little bit asleep at the wheel and maybe Mercedes are in a bit of a mess. Well, what happens in the second half of the season? Because you will surely see those two teams get their act together. Can Aston Martin keep with the pace once that happens, or will they start to move down backwards through the field? That's the second challenge that faces Aston Martin this year.
Now, Alex, Fernando Alonso, a man approaching his 42nd birthday this year, quickly catching up with me. He looks back to his best. Would you agree?
Yeah, 100th podium for Fernando Alonso, but it's been a pair of incredible drives through the first part of this season. But actually what impressed me most about Aston Martin this year was a lap that was actually delivered in the first two sectors, at least by Lance Stroll in Jeddah, recovering from his injuries, of course, in Bahrain. And you ask whether the team are going to be able to keep on this run of form. I really think they are. You know, you saw the amount of oversteer, or certainly I saw in analysis, the amount of oversteer that the Aston Martin had through the mid-corner of turn 13 and the entry point, which eventually caught out Lance Stroll on his qualifying lap in turn 22 in qualifying in Jeddah. And I think in terms of a balance optimization, from a balance optimization perspective, they haven't got the most out of that Aston Martin yet, you know, that it can deliver, that it can deliver aerodynamically. So I do think the future's bright, the future's green.
We talk about a bright future there. Now, Fernando Alonso, I'm going to put you both on the spot here. Fernando Alonso hasn't exactly been lucky with his team choices over the years. You know, had his ING Renault F1 days, good success there, burst onto the scene. But if you stare into your F1 crystal ball, is this a genuine opportunity for him to challenge again? Does he have enough time left to challenge if they continue to grow at this rate? I mean, no one saw this coming, but how far can this go?
how long is a piece of string? One thing, you are right, the clock is ticking for Fernando Alonso. He's going to be 42 at the end of July. It is almost unprecedented in this generation that a driver as old as him is as competitive as he is. I mean, since 1986, we've only had one driver on the podium, one race that was older than Fernando Alonso, and that was Michael Schumacher's last podium at Valencia 2012. It is highly unusual for a driver over 40 to be doing this well. In fact, in the last 53 years, we've had one race won by a driver 40 or over, and that was Nigel Mansell. That was Nigel Mansell's last win in 1994. So it is standard in Formula One, as it is with most sports, that you would see a decline in a driver, in an athlete's performance once you pass the 40th birthday. Now, Fernando Alonso, drinking from the fountain of eternal youth, as he does, doesn't seem to be showing any signs of decline. And Alex, I'd be interested to get your perspective here, especially as a driver. I've always thought that Fernando Alonso's strongest suit was his racecraft. It's not necessarily just the raw pace. It's the fact that he's a shifty, tricky customer to deal with, and he can, you know, he feel like he's got every trick in the book that he can pull out to try and keep an advantage on the racetrack. What was your perspective?
I started next to Fernando Alonso at the Daytona 24 Hours in 2019, I believe. Someone will probably correct me. Oh, there we go. I remember who raced all the Formula One cars. I don't remember where I was, but anyway. It was a random race for him. It was a race that he was coming along just to do for fun. The intensity with which he raced me in the first hour of a 24-hour race was unbelievable. Absolutely, to the outside wall. He's just got that intensity. I firmly believe that the clock starts ticking when you start going slower, and Fernando Alonso hasn't started going slower yet. You'll remember this, Sean. Fangio was in his 50s, wasn't he? When he was.
Well, I don't remember it at the time.
you'll have a number on it, but you know, if he's still delivering, then he's still delivering. And you know, in sports car racing terms, there are a lot of high level drivers who are still delivering. Obviously, Formula One, a different beast, much more G, much more intensity, much more pace required. But, you know, outside that F1 spotlight, I think we've trended towards younger and younger and younger and younger drivers. But there's really no reason physiologically why Fernando can't still do it over the next, you know, 5 years if he's got that intensity and that drive.
And I would add to that also that he's had many, many seasons in the doldrums. When we bear in mind who we're talking about here, he's a two-time champion. Really, he should be more than that. He was so obviously, when he made his debut in Australia 2001 in that Minardi, he was so obviously brilliant. I remember qualifying that weekend. I think this Minardi, which is, you know, it's supposed to be the tail end Charlie. I remember he did a qualifying lap early in that session. He put it like 15th. And we thought, you what? Someone's having a lap. Where'd you find this guy? Now he didn't end up qualifying quite that high, but straight away it was a calling card of, wow, keep an eye on this Spanish guy. He looks really good. And it just carried on being that way. Those who are newer to Formula One know Alonso as this pesky sort of almost like has-been Like, oh yeah, he won loads of races back before I ever watched Formula One. And they've never really seen him at the cutting edge and seen, no, wait till you see him when he has to try and go for a win. Then you'll see just how good this guy is. And it must be like a new lease of life for Alonso, having had all these seasons where he's been trying to get into Q3 and, you know, try to battle for eighth place. When really his talent deserves to be up there with Hamilton and Verstappen and Vettel and, you know, all the other guys from the last 10 years. And finally he has something like that. Now he might need a bit of a tailwind to get a win against these Red Bulls, but at least now we're talking about it as a serious proposition.
Didn't Gale Force tailwind, I think, mate?
Well, we'll see. I mean, if the two Red Bulls run into each other, who knows? But one thing I would say, it's been 10 years since Alonso won a race, and no one's ever gone 10 years between race victories. This week that we're recording is 20 years to the week since Fernando Alonso had his first podium finish. And he was on the podium again this week, which again is staggering. The longevity records are amazing. He's the all-time leader in starts, in laps completed, kilometers raced, number of days between his debut to his last race. And he's still here and he's still at the front. That's the thing. He's not on the grid just to just get the records, you know. It could be argued that Kimi Raikkonen in the last couple of days, you were just like, well, I don't know. I think he's seen better days. Some people would argue that. I'm just saying. In Alonso's case, you can say, hang on a minute. He might break these records and win the race, which is staggering. No, you know, he, statistically speaking, he shouldn't be out there and he's completely blowing up the record books. It's fantastic to watch for somebody who saw Alonso in his prime when he was winning the world championship. We all knew how good he was.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's also fantastic that you can recall these statistics at 4 a.m. in the morning, your time. So fair play to you. Well, that's the thoughts of Sean and Alex. But now it's time to hear from the man whose job it is to push the team on, team principal Mike Crack. Now, this podcast is called Aramco F1 Focus. So we thought we'd kick off these segments by talking about Aramco's relationship with Aston Martin. You may see them just as a name on the side of the Aston Martin AMR23. But as Mike Crack told us, the team's partnership with Aramco goes beyond traditional sponsorship and is actually a key driver of their growth.
Aramco is a technical company and we have quite a lot of projects together with them that focus on future, on sustainability, on environment and efficiency. So all in all, you can describe it as a technological partnership that looks for the to the future. Synthetic fuels are on their arrival. F2, F3, where Aramco will present synthetic fuel. You know, it's such a big company. They have expertise in almost every field, and for us, it can only be beneficial. As I said, you know, many areas where we are working together, and F1 and F1 fuel is obviously one of them. When you start such partnerships, obviously, with a company with that size, you do not really know what is the portfolio of activities that they are having, and it is through getting to know them that you say, oh, we could do something here, we could do something there, you know, or that would be an interesting project. So it's growing, and this opens other doors. So I think all in all, if you see how this has developed, you would not have imagined before. So you know, there is regular meeting of you can call it a steering committee, where they discuss the collaboration, where they discuss different projects and the way forward. You see up and down the pit lane, you know, every team needs substantial partners to support them, to help them on the technological side. They are instrumental in our growth, they are instrumental in our improvements. So it's really good to have them.
Well, there you are. That was Aston Martin's Mike Crack, and that's about it for our first episode. We'll be back with you in a few weeks, but in the meantime, be sure to like, follow, or subscribe to the Race F1 Tech Show podcast feed to ensure you never miss an episode of that podcast or this one. Until next time, it's goodbye from Alex.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Sean.
Thanks, Tim. Speak to you again.
And goodbye from me. Goodbye.
The Athletic.